This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Well, we just touched on it earlier. The Mariners, with 11 games to go, three games back in the wild card. They win again last night in Oakland. Some great moments in that game. And here to talk about all of it, our favorite Bogan on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. He is Ryan Roland Smith. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. I mean, Dave and I have been talking about this all year, Ryan. Just, you know, we look forward to the show being done so we can race home and watch the Mariners. I mean, it's been right. Such a fun season. And listen, I don't know if they're going to make the postseason or not, but they're a winning team now. They are officially a winning team, even if they lose every game till the end of the season, which is far better than anybody was expecting for this team, realistically. And I asked the question earlier, what do you want to see in the remaining 11 games? Obviously, we want to see him get to the postseason, but I said I'd love to see Jared Kelnick continue with his September, by far his best month he's had. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see Seager go out with a bang because I don't think he's coming back. But what is it, any particular things you look at and say, all right, 11 games left, here's what I'd love to see in these 11 games?
Yeah, you mentioned Jared Kelnick. That's a big one. Have a big full month of September, not just like three or four games where he crushes some balls and goes 3 for 4, but a good solid month, because and that goes for a couple of these other guys too. Cal Raleigh, who you notice hasn't been playing as much, he's got to start figuring it out a little bit, because here's the thing with some of these young players, you don't want a situation where you're just trying to, like, you know, pull into the depths of, oh, hey, well, he does this well, oh, he can catch, he can block off-speed pitch as well, or some random thing. You want to see these guys be absolutely established big parts of the lineup when you walk into 2022, so you can start making some real decisions in the offseason. So some of the young guys, you want them to finish up these last couple of weeks absolutely rock solid so that they can go into the offseason feeling really good about being on the team next year, all those little things. You mentioned Kyle Seager. You want to see him go out with a bang. I think just overall, I mean, as far as what they're doing and get to the playoffs, you may run out of games here for them to do it because, hey, they're a good team. Like you said, they're a winning team. They're surprised by the people. There's a lot to take from this year and a lot to build off. But, man, you just wanted to come down to those last couple of games at the very least. Now, Grant Balfour, who's doing my podcast with me now, he's talking about the Oakland A's back in, you know, 2012. They were, with 10 games to go, they're 5 games back in the division. And the wild card was a stretch as well. And all of a sudden, and they had the Texas Rangers in that last series. So they I think they swept the Mariners, and they went into that last series. Basically, it came down to that last game. So at the very least, for some of these guys, especially the young guys and the older guys, you wanted to come down to that last game. That would be amazing, especially going into this offseason. You know, do a bit of a victory lap, regardless if they do make the playoffs or not, and feel good about 2022.
Hey Ryan, have there been times? I was telling Bob that my favorite play was Bowers stealing home on the you know, throw over to first base, and it's just great awareness there. It just seems like as far as coaching goes, because we've talked in the past about, you know, mistakes that have been made and opportunities that weren't taken advantage of. There hasn't been too much of that this year, and as a matter of fact, I think it's shown up the opposite, that the coaching job that they've done this year on these guys has been phenomenal.
Yeah, you make a good point. And plays like that, usually when you walk into a season, and you know, for the most part, you want to be fundamentally sound when it comes to base running and all those boring things you hear, which I agree totally. But when you know your players, and whether it's Bowers taking off on his own because he has that own intuition, or whether it's your third base coach or whatever, your first base coach who knows and understands, has that relationship with the player, knowing that, you know, that guy has the ability not to hesitate in that first step just to take off, or has that speed or whatever it may be. All those little things, they just add, and they just add energy, and they add energy into the dugout as well. On the flip side, obviously, if you start making massive mistakes, base running, well, that's just something that comes down to pressing, trying to force the action, or not knowing your players either. But I've seen, especially base coaches, man, it's a tough job. Everyone just thinks they stand out there and say what's up to the dugout, and, you know, wave into the stands and wave around the runner and do the hero wave when the guy's coming around. It's a tough gig. You have to know the outfielders. You have to know your base runners. You have to know the depth. You have to be switched on the entire time. with 15 different scenarios. So little things like that, they just add up. And you watch, like, for example, the St. Louis Cardinals. They are just a really, really well-rounded team. They're making a massive run. They've got a veteran team, but they do all the little things right. And when there's situations like that where you can be aggressive, where you know your players, the right guy in the right time, they make that those little things happen. So I think that just comes down to the relationship, and that takes a lot of time to build. Whether Jake Bowers is here, you know, for the next couple of years or not, I think from a base coach standpoint, or whatever coach, pitching coach, bullpen coach, the right things just to sort of trigger the right moves for your players is massive.
Well, and speaking of coaches, I'm curious the impact you think the pitching coaches had on guys like Tyler Anderson, like Chris Flexen, two guys who when the Mariners acquired them, we kind of shrugged our shoulders and went, yeah, okay, we'll see what they do. Maybe they can eat up some innings or something like that. You know, I mean, they don't come with a name or a resume. You're going, oh my goodness, what a great pickup. But they are great pickups. Chris Flexen has been the most consistent starter in this rotation from beginning till now. And Tyler Anderson has been fantastic. And you know, you look at their numbers of the past, there's nothing to tell you they would be these guys. So do you look at that and say, hey, you know, they just got the right voice in their ear now. Or they're just somebody found the right mechanical thing to put into the repertoire, whatever it is, they're just in the right spot now?
You never have, and a lot of people listening will be like, well, Tyler Anderson was doing great, and he just got traded over. Hey, look, you're on your own program. Just do what you need to do. I never, ever buy into that, ever. I've never experienced that, and guys I've talked to have never had a situation where they've come into a team, whether it's Chris Flexen or Tyler Anderson in a trade or whatever, come into a situation where they've shook hands with a pitching coach, and he said, hey, man, look, you're a stud. You're a veteran. Just go ahead and do your thing, and I'll just kind of stand here. There's always, always input, and it always starts with what kind of who do you vibe with? What kind of pitching coach do you vibe with? I've had some amazing pitching coaches. Even if the information isn't the best, you trust it and you listen to them because you know they've got your back, and you have that relationship with them. So, for example, Chris Flexen, and obviously Tyler Anderson and Chris Flexen are both coming from different places, right? Obviously, Chris Flexen was out of the big leagues. He was done and dusted. Was never going to pitch in big leagues again. Goes to Korea, has some success, and here he is signing a 2-year deal. So he comes into this, and Pete Woodworth, I guarantee you, they would have sat down multiple times, even before the season started, identifying what kind of pitcher he is, how he profiles, what this pitch really does, why he should throw in this situation. Now, look, you could have the best. You could have an absolute, you know, genie in a bottle with giving you all these, you know, looking into a crystal ball, whatever. If you don't trust it, it makes no difference on the information. Pete Woodworth does an amazing job with a situation when he's got a Marco Gonzalez, because it's obvious, man, that they have found ways to evolve even when they're going through some tough times, or Logan Gilbert having to trust the fact that he has to start throwing a slider a little bit differently. He's hung with it, and now look at the result. Marco Gonzalez had a terrible first half, was lost. And all of a sudden, you have to bounce off. Obviously, you know, they bounce off other guys. But having that pitching coach, you're around them pretty much every day of the year, of the season. You're around them every single day. You better have some sort of connection with them. And you better bounce things back and forth. They make a massive difference.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the acquisitions that they made during the season, the thing that has stood out is that they've worked out. And so you mentioned a little bit Tyler Anderson. You know, he's got an ERA since, you know, his 10 games start, not a huge sample size, but it's better than any time in his career. What do you see from Tyler Anderson?
I think he's in a situation where, and look, he's been a model of consistency throughout his career, and he's been with a few different teams and everything else. He's in a situation now that he totally identifies and understands exactly what kind of pitcher he is. And, man, that must be a nice feeling because, okay, when you have these different stages, when you're a young pitcher, and let's say you're Tyler Anderson, if he's a young pitcher and they're saying, look, you throw a ton of pitches, you get a lot of foul balls, we need you to develop something to get swings and misses. So all of a sudden you go through that and you get away from really how you profile to have success. Well, I think with Tyler Anderson, he's at that situation now where he has shown that he can have enough success. Yes, he throws a ton of pitches. He's going to get five or six. And the other night he went deeper than that the other night. But he understands that, you know what, I'm going to pitch to contact. My swing and miss rate's not going to be great, but I do get a huge contact. The chase percentage is through the roof in the zone or out the zone. I'm just going to work off this. This is me. This is the kind of pitcher I am. So when he comes into a situation, the Seattle Mariners obviously want him. When you get traded over, someone obviously wants you and thinks very highly of you. And now all of a sudden you have that comfort factor of, you know what, this is who they acquired. This is what they like about me. We've identified what works, and you just go to work. Whereas on the flip side, similar kind of situation, Justus Sheffield is a young pitcher getting way too much contact. All of a sudden he wants to go back to, oh, I need to get swings and misses. And what happens is when you chase those swings and misses too much, you end up getting in deep counts, you're getting those 2-0, 2-1 counts, and you start getting hit. So I think for Tyler Anderson, he's at that stage, first of all, his career, second of all, where he is with the Mariners and that kind of relationship he's had with the coaches and everyone else. This is who I am, and man, I can be one of the best guys in a rotation being this kind of pitcher.
Looking at Dave and I were talking about, you know, sort of looking ahead to next year and again, working with the assumption that Kyle won't be back, and I'd like him back for the record, but I just don't think he will. So you start going, all right, who plays third? Well, you know, obviously Toro's got experience at third. Ty France has experience there. You've got options there. How do you see it shaking out? I mean, I know Evan White is sort of the wild card because you're going, all right, can the guy hit? Yeah. You know he's got a special level of defense. I mean, as great as Ty France has been, Evan White is still a step above that defensively.
Yeah.
But how do you see the infield shaking out? And maybe they're picking up somebody, you know, a free agent that's a big-time bat, and you know, who's an infielder. But ultimately, with the pieces they've got, how would you set it up?
I think they, and you've seen this historically the last couple of years especially, Jerry DiPoto and the Seattle Mariners, they value defense a lot. That works in Evan White's favor. Now, if they didn't, if they said, well, look, you have to hit and you have to hit now, that wouldn't work in his favor. So I think with Evan White going into spring training now, and like you mentioned too, this offseason could be interesting. They could go out and get a big bat. Let's and obviously we're assuming Kyle Seager doesn't come back.
Right.
I think the plan is, and it kind of stays this way, Abraham Toro slides over to third base, and then you've got Ty France sliding to second, Evan White at first base. But I will say this, regardless of Evan White with the fact that, oh, hey, look, he signed a long-term deal, that he's just going to, that's his spot, and that's just the way it goes. That's not the case at all. I think if it's a situation where he's not healthy right away, or there's something quite different, that's something they're going to evaluate over the offseason, then they're going to, you know, once you get around the winter meetings, they'll address the fact that, okay, we need another bat here, and it's got to be a corner infielder, I think. Now, if he's in the offseason, he, you know, starts making some adjustments, obviously the offseason is tough to figure that out, comes into spring training and he looks confident and can hit his ability, hey, great, we can sit on this. We can have Evan White playing first base. But I'm telling you, I think it's a situation now, 2022, it's time to win. This team's proven that they can be, if they add some pieces, they can win. And I think Evan White, he's in a crunch situation that he has to come in spring training especially, and prove that he's going to be a part of that. It's past the point of development. It's past the point of waiting to see if he can hit, I think.
Hey, Ryan, do you also believe that Canna has a punchable face? He got hit by the 26th time last night. And I think, is he ahead of Ty France?
Yeah, I think he's two ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, we talked about Ty France, but, yeah, first of all, that, and then, you know, same thing, he just doesn't get out of the way, right?
Yeah, it's a situation. I mean, obviously the way he's set up on the play, he doesn't bail at all. And, you know, I mean, I remember you guys, I can't remember who it was, Misevich, I believe. He said he looks like he's got a punchable face.
Yeah.
Which was gold. That was a couple of months back, I remember.
Yeah, he agreed with us on
that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I had a good chuckle at that. I just think Canna's a guy who just doesn't get out of the way. But just, yeah, one thing, besides the fact he doesn't get out of the way, just his reaction every time he gets hit, or if he, you know, if an umpire misses a call or something, it's just like, dude, no wonder you get hit so much. It just suits you, the fact that you're getting drilled, what, 26-something times.
It's your face.
With the way you carry on.
Yeah, it's his expressions and complaining.
Well, and it's the eternity in between pitches. You see how long he takes. He's going through his little mechanics and I'm going to swing this way. You can see the wheels turning. It's just something about his demeanor where you're just like, yeah, I think you're worthy of being plunked. Yeah.
Hey. Yeah, exactly. Him and your boy Cole Irvin too, the guy who's starting for the
yeah
tonight.
Well,
listen, man, Since he pitched to the Mariners, he was giving it up until the last couple of starts, and I was just sitting there going, here we go. But just, you know, that comment, it's one of these things, and regardless of how the Mariners reacted to it, look, it's one of these things that, dude, you have barely sniffed a year in the big leagues. You don't, you cannot afford to say things like that. You just don't. That's when we talk about unwritten rules. Don't say that about guys who are gold glovers, all stars, you know, hitting 30-something home runs in the middle of a lineup. That's just ridiculous. You know?
Yeah, well, and he's gotten his butt kicked by them twice since making those comments, so hasn't worked out well for him. Hey, one guy I'm sort of curious about, and he's not a superstar, but he's a guy that I love his presence on the team, what he brings. He's a multi, you know, he can do a bunch of different things. A down year for Dylan Moore, hitting under 200. I mean, he's a guy who can steal bases. You can play him at multiple spots, but just been really inconsistent up at the plate. Does he have a place on this roster, do you think, next year? I'm trying to figure out. I love the presence. I love the ability to go to him in different spots, but man, he's got you just can't have that many guys who are hitting below 200.
No, you can't. And sometimes I like to look at this. I used to do this when you'd see guys get called up for, let's say, and I'm just throwing names out there. Let's say you see someone get called up with the Angels, right? For example, and you look over and say, if he was on with the Boston Red Sox in AA or AAA, where would he be? And sometimes the answer is, man, he would be an A-ball. That's how deep they are. Like, that's one example. Now, for Dylan Moore, this is a situation, I do this all the time. With Dylan Moore, let's say you've got the Rays, let's say you've got the Houston Astros, the LA Dodgers. I'm just throwing some teams out there. Where would Dylan Moore fit on those rosters? The teams that are winning and are just killing it in their division, right? Or the Giants or whoever. Where are they going to the playoffs? Where would he fit in that roster? Would he fit there? Would he have a place? And I say that because the Mariners, again, it's business time now. 2022, let's build a winner. Now, if you're going to be one of these teams like the Dodgers, who are just up and down depth-wise, ridiculous, the Houston Astros, the same thing, where does he fit? Where does he fit into that? So, again, another guy who's auditioning at the end of this month, but it's going to be interesting this offseason. If the Mariners go big and they start spending some money and filling up some of these holes, especially that 1-9, it's going to be a tough spring training if he's with the Mariners next year, that's for sure.
One of the things I like about you, Ryan, is that you're very plain speaking. You don't try to use fancy terms. I was saying that now that the Kraken is coming to town, I'm going to go and brush up on all these fancy pants, you know, terms and everything, and I'm going to try to act like a hockey expert because we get that in football and stuff. Do you know much? You know much about hockey?
I will say this: my favorite sport to watch live. Right, like we would go to spring training, or I'd go to my in-laws. I live in Arizona, and sure enough, man, I check the schedule before I go. Now I love it. Do I follow the NHL on TV? No, I don't. I got two kids running around. I can't be sitting here watching sport all day, and I'm covering a baseball team as well. So I'm not like locked in. I'm not going to sit here and pretend to act like I can break down the analytics of the goaltender, you know, of anything regarding that. I will say I am super excited. I went to the practice field. Listen to me, the spring training site. No, I went to the training facility up in Northgate. And I was like, man, this is getting me pumped up. I was about to, you know, drop $20 on a hat, but I was like, no, I'm too tight to do that. No, but I'm excited now. I'm gonna get myself a jersey.
Wait, you'll get a free one somewhere down the road. They'll give you a free one, man.
I'm too tight to do that.
Hey, they're big time, dude. You can't even get tickets to the game. I've tried to drop hints left, right, and center. I'm getting no love at all. Like when it comes to like getting just a ticket to a game or you know, a free fleece or something, nothing. Man, it's slim pickings.
So I love that.
I will watch for sure.
$20 for a hat. I'm too tight to do that. Are you a frugal guy? Is that what's going on?
Oh yeah, massive. Yeah.
Oh yeah,
I am, and my wife is too. We enjoy it, man. Like we don't spend money on anything. We're pretty tight. That's for sure.
We enjoy not spending money together.
Well, I saw the entertainment was at the Monster Truck Pole, and so you know those tickets are fairly cheap, I guess. So.
I love that they have fun not spending money together. That's I've never heard that.
We did go to Monster Jams on Sunday. That was on Sunday. I will say the Monster Trucks. Of course, and I should throw some photos out on Twitter. That was a
yes,
blast.
Yes, please.
But no, we yeah, I was loving it, but I was trying to keep it under wraps because it was like, oh man, look at this. But No, it was fun. I got to say the Gravedigger was the El Toro Loco truck. So those two were just insane. They were great.
I love it.
Some of the stunts.
I love
great
it.
Athletes.
The picture you send, you got your beautiful little kids, your beautiful model wife sitting there, and then, you know, it's like, oh, look at this nice picture of Ryan's family, and then you pan over, and there's a fire-breathing truck in the middle. Yeah.
And I wish you could have put audio to the photo, too, because it's just blaring in there. Like, yeah. my poor daughter can't hear for 3 weeks.
Well, no, I remember you had like earmuffs or headphones or whatever on your daughter. So,
yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Did you buy anything when you made it to the big leagues? Did you go out and buy a car? Did you buy a house at some point? Or did you pinch pennies through your big league career as well?
Well, I did that too. I did buy a car. That's the one thing I did. I bought a car, but I bought a house. Like, as soon as I could, my parents were all over me. Hey, you have to buy real estate right away. Boom. So I did. So I bought a house right away, locked that in. I actually still owned that up until early this year. But now, listen, I'm exaggerating. Obviously, you know, we go out and do some fun things, but at the same time, we stick to a budget. You know what I mean? We're pretty on the same page when it comes to that kind of stuff. So
you see him walking around with a handful of coupons and stuff. Hey, I got a coupon for that. We got 2 for 1.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it past me. I'm telling you right now.
Ryan,
sure.
Ryan, great stuff, man. We appreciate it. We'll do it again next week.
Sounds good. Appreciate it, guys.
There you go. There's Ryan Roland Smith. I love it. $20 for a hat. I'm too tight to do that.
Yeah. Well, you can't let him, you know, you got to save him there a little bit. Like, oh, come on, man. It's not like you're cheap or anything. And he's like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I am.
I love that he says him and his wife have fun not spending money together. We have a good time with that. That's awesome.
Hey, I think he meant they find ways to, like I told you the other one where they've got like the Winnebago and they had like the blue tarp that was like their little.
Oh, yeah. You told me about it. I didn't see it. You told me about
They're out
that.
In the middle like with a campfire. I mean, it's old school.
So funny. I love Ryan. All right, coming up, UW football is about to start conference play, and Seattle Times beat writer Mike Varell will join us for Washington Wednesday. That is coming up next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Washington Wednesdays, brought to you by Star Rentals, preferred supplier to the West's best contractors.
It is Wednesday, so it's time for Washington Wednesdays. We talk some Husky football. In order to do that, you got to bring in the experts, Dave. Bring in a guy who knows a thing or two about this team, who can educate all of us, and he covers the team for the Seattle Times. He's with us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Our buddy Mike Varell is with us. Mike, how are you, man?
Can't complain. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good. Does a 52-3 butt-whipping of Arkansas State wash away all of the ill will that seemed to have been created in the first two games of the season? I mean, there was a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of this guy should be fired, this guy should be benched, you know how it goes. So does Arkansas State, that game, do much to calm that down?
It doesn't wash anything away. I think maybe it cleans up some of the smudges, but obviously the results are what they are, and they're not going to hang their hat. Jimmy Lake is not going to make a reputation on beating Arkansas State. He's got to beat, you know, a team like Michigan. He's got to beat a team like Cal, like on Saturday. You know, what they're saying is that, you know, all of their goals in terms of a Rose Bowl and a Pac-12 title are still in front of them, but there's still an awful lot to prove, especially if you're someone like offensive coordinator John Donovan, who's only had 7 games here and hasn't gone particularly well. So it helps to get a win for sure and you get some momentum, but they're going to have to show that they really are the team from this past Saturday, not the one that looks pretty disappointing against both Montana and Michigan.
Hey, Mike, tell us about the quarterback situation. Dylan Morris with 23 for 39, 367, threw a couple picks, but had 3 touchdowns. And then we saw a little bit of Sam Huard as well.
Yeah, I mean, Dylan Morris is their guy. There's not a quarterback competition going on there, but he's obviously a second-year starter. He's struggled a bit at times this season. He's thrown 5 interceptions in 3 games, which you don't want to see. But obviously the offense as a whole has struggled, and I think he's a guy who, you know, he has 3.5 seasons of eligibility remaining. They like him a lot. They like his ability to kind of negotiate the offense, diagnose defenses, and they're hopeful that they found something against Arkansas State. So we'll see if he continues to take strides. As far as Sam Huard, obviously a 5-star freshman and a guy with a ton of promise and the all-time passing leader. for a high school player in the state of Washington. So there's a huge pedigree there. It was nice for him to kind of get his feet wet. I don't think the QB competition is all that close. I don't think if Dylan struggles against Cal, you're necessarily going to see Sam, but he's certainly a player that fans want to see. And at some point you'd think he would sort of take over that position, although I'm not sure it's going to be this season.
Mike, what was the expectation surrounding this team in the way of, you talked about what Jimmy Lake is talking about, hey, the Rose Bowl's still in front of us, everything's still there to be had. What was the realistic expectation? What did you think this team was capable of coming into the season?
The realistic expectation was to compete for a Pac-12 title. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this is a team in the past that has recruited very well. I mean, they only played 4 games last season, but they technically won the Pac-12 North. I know that's kind of, there's an asterisk over everything. But it was a very talented team. It was a very deep team when it comes to talent. So when it comes to losing to Montana, that was completely inexplicable, and that was a massive disappointment. The Michigan game, same thing. I mean, this was before the season, UW was favored to beat Michigan, and obviously they were a team that was supposed to be coming in with a lot of momentum. Michigan was a team that was 3-5 last year, and that's not the way that it looked. So there were big expectations. I think they were realistic. I think, you know, we asked Jimmy Lake before the season, what's a fair expectation every year for his program? And he said they should be competing for a Pac-12 title every year. That should be the expectation. Compete for a Pac-12 title, play in a big bowl game. That's their expectation every season. So that's what he's laid down for himself. And obviously, they did not look like a team was capable of reaching that in their first 2 games. Maybe they can turn that around, but we're going to have to see starting this Saturday.
And, Mike, what do you make of the Pac-12 this week? Northern Arizona beats Arizona. San Diego State beats Utah. And Colorado looked like they were giving A&M a challenge a couple weeks ago, lost that game. But then they just get whooped by Minnesota. And then, you know, and look, Fresno State, always a tough program. But they beat UCLA. And I thought, you know, UCLA after whooping LSU, you know, you would think, hey, there's no way they fall to a team like that. What do you think about the competition?
Yeah, it's been, you know, hugely disappointing for the Pac-12, and obviously, you know, this isn't new, but I think there was sort of a quiet confidence among Pac-12 coaches prior to the season that this was going to be a pretty good year for that conference and that they were going to turn a couple of heads, especially when you think, you know, with the coronavirus year and there being an extra year of eligibility, a lot of these teams have a bunch of 4th, 5th, 6th-year guys. There's more experience on these Pac-12 rosters, so for some of them to have played, you know, like they played, Washington included, is a big disappointment. Of course, when you have an Oregon beat an Ohio State, that's the kind of marquee win that they haven't had in years, but they just haven't been able to back it up outside of that program. Then again, though, I mean, the ACC has had Clemson go to the playoff every year, and beyond that, they've had no depth in that conference. So maybe having the big heavyweight will kind of change perception, but certainly outside of Oregon, it hasn't been a strong showing.
Hey, Mike, just in terms of the offense, and you know, we talked about expectations coming in, you got new coordinator there. I mean, what is your take on what you've seen? I, you know, we can sit here and read everybody's reaction to everything going on around the offense, and this guy doesn't know what he's doing. He didn't have the pedigree coming in, so what did you expect? What did you expect offensively versus what you've seen in just in the way of being, you know, creative with what they've got to work with?
Yeah, I think what happened against Montana was that this was a offense that knew that what it wanted to do going in, and then in the week of the game, and for one player before that, but mostly in the week of the game, lost its top 4 wide receivers and basically shut it down offensively from a schematic creativity standpoint, and thought that they could just boulder over Montana, and that was a massive miscalculation. Obviously, I don't think it's easy for any team to be down with top 4 wide receivers. You never really see that happen. And they're starting to get those guys back when it's Dylan McMillan, Trell Bynum. But their top guys, they've gotten back the last couple of weeks and have looked a little different. But, you know, it's unfortunate. The John Donovan coming in, you know, Jimmy Lake wants to run a pro-style scheme. He wants to, you know, show teams how physical they can be and dominate the line of scrimmage. But there just hasn't been enough there in terms of innovation, in terms of deception. And they're starting to use that more and more. I think they did against Arkansas State. Part of it was a personnel thing who they didn't have, but also, you know, the way that teams are running offense, you know, UW just wasn't doing that, wasn't trusting its players to do that against Montana. And we'll have to see against Cal if there's a little bit more of the RPO stuff, the play action stuff, the stuff that we didn't see early on.
Well, and what do you make of Donovan calling the game from the press box on Saturday? You know, he'd been on the field before that, and I read a quote where he was wanting to learn the players or how they're going to react in situations, and I guess he's comfortable with it now, so he can go up in the press box. What do you make of that?
I mean, I do buy that explanation when you've got a guy coming in, and then because of COVID, you essentially don't even meet your players, where you're doing everything over Zoom. Just being down there, like, you know, what Jimmy Lake said, is to see if a guy, you know, looks terrified and to really kind of understand the psyche of his guys. He wanted to be down on the field. But obviously, schematically, it's easier to see some things from the press box. It's easier to see the way the defenses are playing you. And he went up there this past week. At this point, when you're 0-2 and you've scored 17 combined points, I think you're going to tinker with some things. So is that a solution? Probably not. But I think it's something that they had to try, and we'll see if they find some more success on Saturday.
Mike Varell of the Seattle Times, UW beat writer, has been our guest here with Wyman and Bob. Mike, we appreciate it as always, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
All right, guys. Thank you.
There you go. Mike Varell for Washington Wednesdays. We'll see if that thumping of Arkansas State translates to a win over Cal, 52-3.
The Pac-12 to me is really all I care about. I mean, I watch the SEC games every once in a while just because, you know, there was a great game last week, Florida, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
But I care, and I'll even root for like UCLA and Cal and everything. Just want this.
You want the conference to do well.
To do well.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. All right, coming up, would we have all this drama if the Seahawks had won that game in overtime? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
What?
What?
What? What?
It's time for What If Wednesday.
Coach would have put me in fourth quarter. We'd have been state champions, no doubt.
Wyman and Bob rewrite the scripts of major moves and moments in sports every Wednesday afternoon. Now step into an alternative reality with Wyman and Bob.
It is What If Wednesday. We play out the hypothetical. We do it before Clayton because, as we've come to learn, he doesn't enjoy hypotheticals. Just doesn't compute for him. So we get it out of the way before we talk to John, who will join us at the top of the hour, talk some NFL with him. But What If Wednesday, by the way, is presented by Hardwick and Pendergast, personal injury attorneys. What if the Seahawks had won that game in overtime? Everything's the same. The yardage given up, the play, you know, Derrick Henry runs for 8,000 yards. Everything's exactly the same except for the final score. And they win that game. Are we in here wringing our hands about, man, are we saying that they got lucky? How do you give up 532 yards or whatever it was and 180 yards of the running back and then this, that, and the other happened, yet you were able to win the game by the skin of your teeth in overtime? How much different would the conversation be?
Yeah, I would say, it would be pretty much the same, that, look, that was a really good team. Because I think then the conversation would be, this team was banged up. They had second stringers that were starting on defense. They were coming off a bad loss against Arizona. Why was it that close?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you got to take care of business at home. And, you know, and I would probably be saying, hey, that was a really good team that you just beat. And I still believe that. So, yeah, my answer would be kind of boring, but it's a great question from the standpoint of, you know, how we think about this team. And I like, you know, your thought in the email last night of kind of stepping back and looking at, like, how good is this team? I mean, you know, we loved the week one, the opener in Indianapolis, and, you know, the D-line looked great. I mean, everybody, you feel really good about your solid defense, but then all of a sudden you go, how many NFL cities do they know who Rasheem Green is or Al Woods or – well, Al Woods, actually, he's played in most NFL cities. But
yeah, it's true.
But, yeah, I mean, there's just not a lot of – there's, I think, stars in the making, like Alton Robinson.
Right,
but,
and maybe, you know, Brooks at some point, maybe or maybe Jordan Taylor Brooks at some point. But
yeah, maybe
right
DJ
now,
Reed.
Yeah, but right now they're guys.
Yeah.
Probably most fans have not heard of them.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think you have to kind of step back and think about, you know, where the Seahawks realistically are. But, you know, you look on offense and you have Russell. You know, I think you have a Derrick Henry in the making, but if Chris Carson can play – remember, Derrick Henry played in every single game last year.
Yep.
And I think he was the only guy to go over 1,000 or that, or the only starter to actually play in every game. Look what happened with Christian McCaffrey. They gave him $16 million a year, and he missed 13 games.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just one of those positions. But anyway, back to my point is, you know, if Carson can be at least, you know, close, and you could say if he just got half the yardage, he would still have over 1,000.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Derrick
especially
Henry,
now with 17 games.
Yeah. And, yeah, by the way, the new number is 58, 59, I think, for 1,000 yards.
To average 59 yards per game as running, which we
it was
we looked
62,
at the box
five.
Score after the game. You go 60, 59 yards. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, not that great, but that'll get you 1,000 yards. But I think the new standard probably has to be more like 1,100, right?
I think the standard should have been higher for 1,000.
Yeah.
You're talking about 62 and a half yards a game. You're not looking at that running back going, that's an elite running back.
Yeah, superstar.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, you're right. But, you know, typically it's like you get three or four games that, you know, where the guy runs over 100, and then you get some of those other games that, you know, are more like 40, 50, whatever. But if you get, you know, him, Russell, DK, and Lockett, you know, that's pretty much what Tennessee has. You know, there's no way you could compare Tannehill to Russell, but he's a good quarterback, really good quarterback.
Yeah, he's showing he can be efficient. And more importantly, he didn't make mistakes. He didn't kill him.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't lie to, he didn't throw for a touchdown. That's the amazing part in this game. He didn't have a touchdown pass.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. You're right. He doesn't get you in trouble. He just keeps it safe. And, you know, he was just okay, but, you know, he can hit the open receiver.
Yeah, didn't get picked off. He did fumble once. But for the most part, he's a guy, you know, the dreaded term game manager. Yeah. He can throw. He piled up 347 yards through the air, so he can move the ball around. But I don't know that he's a guy you go in there fearing, so to speak. But, yeah, that's more about Henry and Julio Jones and Brown. I just, you know, to answer the question, you know, what if they would have won this game? Everything's the same. Stats are the same except the score. I think we're having close. You certainly feel better. You're 2-0. You feel like, all right, you gutted it out. You found a way to win when things weren't going right. You know, and that's always the sign of a good team. When you don't have your A game, when you find a way to grind it out.
Yeah.
And you come away with a win, that shows resilience. That shows an ability to adapt and overcome. I think it is a different conversation, but I think we still have this. I think we'd be in here going, man, the defense gave up how many yards? Yeah. They gave up over 300 in the second half. And by the way, for those that are texting in saying, well, it's Russell's fault and the offense they were on the field too long, I would just ask you to go look at the drive chart. Look at the drive chart from the first quarter on and see how long the Seahawks were on the field before you could cite fatigue as a problem.
Well, and the thing is, too, is that, you know, their third down percentage wasn't, like, horrible, but they were getting stuff done on first and second down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they couldn't get off the field.
But you look at like, the second drive of the game for the Titans. 13 plays, 70 yards, almost 7 minutes. There's no fatigue at that point where the offense just left you out to dry and, man, we're gassed. That's the second drive of the game for the Titans. They're out there for almost 7 minutes of clock time on the field. Resulted in a field goal. So they were doing the bend but don't break. So they were, you know, they were getting some fortunate plays, fortunate bounces, if you will, able to hold them to field goals. But in terms of fatigue and they're out there on the field too long and it's Russell's fault, go look at it. It started in the very first quarter. The very first quarter, you look at the length of the drives they had. And then you look at the very first drive of the second half. Titans had the ball first. You had halftime to rest. You're in there. You're rehydrating. You're doing all that. Fatigue shouldn't be a problem. The very first drive of the second half, Titans go 8 plays, 80 yards, 4.5 minutes. Drove right down the field on you.
Well, and you look at, they nearly had the ball for 3 quarters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's tough. And also, you were down a D lineman. Remember Monet?
Yeah.
On game day was down. So, yeah, the big guys had to go a little bit more. You didn't get the fresh rotation there.
All right. Coming up, the professor will join us. If you guys have questions for John, you can text those in right now to 710-710, the Mac and Jack's text line. He's going to join us next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.